This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
So the first question we have is, please explain the Salafi or the Wahhabi movement and how it differs from mainstream Islam. The Salafi or the Wahhabi movement is a trend within Sunni Islam. This trend has a number of key theological differences that make it separate from the other strands of Sunni Islam. And in a nutshell, they are extremely Protestant in their understanding of the faith. What do I mean by this? Their main criticisms are against what they believe to be an excessive veneration of saints. So they want a direct relationship between man and God. And they want to go back to the original. So many people say that Salafism is a type of Protestant Reformation, if you like. And of course, there are parallels. With every parallel, there are also differences. But essentially, Salafists want a very pure understanding of Islam that goes back to how it was originally practiced, theologically. They're not saying that we should go back technologically, no. They're saying theologically, ritualistically, we should go back to the very early stage of Islam. And there's a lot of academics talk about Salafism and Wahhabism and how it's linked to terrorism. And I have my own theories about this as well. And in a nutshell, I think that the linkage that has been made with Salafism and terrorism is somewhat overstretched. The fact of the matter is that there are radical movements from other strands as well. Simple example is the Taliban of Afghanistan. The Taliban of Afghanistan have nothing to do with the Salafi strand. And there are other movements as well that we can point out that... And the Iranian Revolution in 1979 has nothing to do with Salafism as well. So there are radical strands in every single interpretation of Islam. Salafism, generally speaking, is very quietist and pacifist because they view politics as corrupting to the soul. So generally speaking, Salafists are apolitical. And as a counter-reaction, there has been a strand of Salafism that has gone radical jihadist as a counter-reaction to the apolitical quietist. The mainstream normative Salafism is actually completely apolitical. They don't want to get involved in politics. In fact, even in Muslim countries, they say don't even vote because all politicians are corrupt and evil. Frankly, many of us might be Salafis if we look at that perspective. But my point is that they just believe that politics is corruptive to the soul. And it's just best to avoid politics. Because Salafis are so apolitical, a strand of them has counter-reacted to that. And there's no doubt that Bin Laden and others came from that strand. But to blame the entire strand for that is simply not academically accurate. And I don't necessarily view Salafism or Wahhabism as being inherently more terroristic than others. They are fundamentalist, but that's not the same as terroristic. They are very conservative, but that's not the same as evangelicals are conservative. I mean, they have a very strict interpretation, but that's not the same as wanting violence. I have lived in the movement when the university I went to is the premier Salafi university in the world. I have been a part of the movement in my previous, 20 years ago, 10 years ago, I've since moved on. And even though I'm a critic for many reasons, I'm trying to be fair and say that they're not any more prone to terrorism than any other strand of Islam. Three questions in one. Okay. Okay, no worries.
Okay, so the second question is, do you condemn all forms of hate and bigotry, even when they are directed towards Christians and other religious practitioners living in Muslim-majority countries? And if so, please explain. Okay, so my Afghan friend tells me that unmarried pregnant women should be killed. How do you handle this in America? Rachel Raza of the Christian Project shows a disturbing video about millions of Muslims who support honor killings. Please refute her.
Okay, those are three totally unrelated questions, by the way. But anyway, no worries, I'll do all three one by one. Hatred and bigotry against non-Muslims, against Christians. There's no doubt that any Muslim in the world of a reasonable mind, all of us in this room are of that mind, we understand that this hatred and bigotry that is taking place is against the teachings of our religion. Are there Muslims who hate Christians? Yes, there are. Are there Muslims who theologically believe that Christians should be persecuted? Yes, they are. But that's not mainstream. And every example that you quote, any example, look at that very country. It might not be ideal, but there are Christians thriving there. Look at Islamic history. The most ancient sects of Christianity have always flourished in Muslim lands. Nestorians, go back to Iraq. The Maronites in Lebanon. The Coptics in Egypt. To this day, 10% of Egypt remains Coptic. These are the most ancient. They predate Catholicism and Protestant Christianity by 500 years. There are still strands of the ancient remnants of Christianity in these Muslim lands. Agreed, they're not living the same types of freedoms as perhaps Muslims are enjoying in Western countries. I agree with you. I'm not sugarcoating it. But to claim that Islam as an entire race has always persecuted Christians, that's simply false. It is true, and we get to the concept of Sharia here, medieval Islamic law, true, no denying this, medieval Islamic law had a categorization system. And there's no sugarcoating this. Muslims had certain privileges that non-Muslims didn't have. But I think it's unfair to equate those laws with modernity. You should equate those laws with Europe at the time. Then you're talking fair and square. If you're going to equate medieval Islam with modern human rights convention, no, that's not, you're right. There are a lot of disparities. But let's look at Christianity in the Muslim world and compare that to intra-Christian warfare in the European side of things. I mean, what were the Puritans of this country fleeing from? Muslim persecution? No. So let's be fair and compare equally. I'm not sugarcoating it, but the fact of the matter is that the amount of freedoms that medieval Islam gave to other religions was unprecedented in Europe. And that is why John Locke, somebody whom the founding fathers all read and benefited from, one of the main visionaries of America, John Locke wrote in his famous epistle, A Letter Concerning Toleration. He wrote that, fellow Europeans, why don't you look at the Muslims, the Ottomans, the Turks, he said, and look at their toleration. Look at the irony. 300 years ago, a European is telling his fellow Europeans, let's learn some toleration from the Ottomans, the Turks. Because the fact of the matter is, we have now, we're in a different world. We're in the world of nation states. We're in the world of nation states. And having different laws for different nationalities is considered to be totally rational and reasonable. So when I'm going to Europe in 3 weeks, as soon as I land, there's going to be big signs, EU to the right, everybody else to the left. Now I'm going to be shepherded and heralded to a long line. I'm going to be quizzed and grilled. What are you doing here? What is the purpose of your visit? I'm treated differently than somebody from the EU, right? Look at us here in America, how we treat, look at what we call them, illegal aliens, as if they're from Mars. I mean, look at what we call them, illegal aliens, right? So we have a way of hierarchy that is based on the nation state. Look at the rhetoric against Obama. Where did your mother give birth to you? Who cares where his mother gave birth? And frankly, as a human being, let me say, who cares? How does that qualify you to be a better human being, where your mother gave birth to you? But that's the way we categorize people. And that's totally normal and rational in the world we live in. Well, guess what? 500 years ago, the Muslim world had a different way of categorizing people. And I'm not going to defend it. I'm not going to criticize it. That's the way it was. They would categorize people based upon religion. And if you were of a certain religion, you would have certain privileges. If you weren't of that religion, you had the freedom to practice your faith. But, and I'm not going to sugarcoat it, you didn't have the same privileges. Now, should that law be cut and pasted from medieval textbooks to modern nation states? I argue no, it shouldn't. But some clerics do. And that's an internal discussion. We're going to have it. We're having it in the Muslim world. And I'm of those that says we need to update those laws. But at the same time, so the reality is that Islamic law never persecuted Christians. The very fact, for example, these Yazidis that are now being persecuted by ISIS, they were living there for 2,000 years under a legitimate bona fide caliphate, i.e. the Ottomans, and then the Abbasids before them, and then the Umayyads before them. These were the actual caliphs of medieval Islam. The Christians that left from Mosul, Iraq, the Christians that fled, do you know how many years they've been there? Since the time of Jonah. This is the time of Jonah, of Nineveh. That's where Mosul is, Nineveh, right there. Right? Since the time of Jonah, there have been people that believe in... So they've been there for the longest time. Why is it that they're fleeing now? Because ISIS's interpretation is not typical of mainstream Orthodox Islam. The very fact that you have Arab Christians that trace their roots 2,000 years in that land, and they're fleeing for the first time, is enough to indicate something is not normal about these people. They're not representing even medieval mainstream Islam. And that is a clear historical point that you can use as a reference. That was the first question. The unmarried, pregnant things. Honestly, I don't know which law this is of unmarried, pregnant. Islamic, medieval Islamic law. And again, there's no sugarcoating. You're going to hear me very frank. Honesty is always the best policy. And as a person of God, I think it's a sin to lie in any way, in any situation. Does medieval Islamic law prescribe the death penalty for extramarital sex? Yes, it does. It does prescribe the death penalty for extramarital, not premarital. Adultery, basically. Yes, it does. But once again, how often was this law actually applied, even in medieval times? Was this the norm, or was this a type of scare tactic so that people don't actually commit adultery? Even according to our own medieval scholars, this law is actually meant more as something in the books to terrify you, rather than to actually implement. And it is very rare, even in medieval Islam, to come across these occurrences. Should they be updated and modernized? Again, that's an ongoing discussion. And that's one of the main sources of intra-Muslim dialogue. We are debating amongst ourselves. I am sure many Jews and many Christians understand this. The texts say things that are somewhat problematic at times. All religious people know what I'm talking about here, right? The texts have some laws that are somewhat bizarre. And this is all texts. Need I quote you Leviticus and Deuteronomy and whatnot? I mean, you understand my point here. So Muslims do need to have that dialogue, and they are having it. But the claim that somehow this is representative of mainstream, or even worse, that this is somehow relevant to us American Muslims, I mean, that's simply preposterous. What has this act got to do with us here? I understand that at a theoretical level, it's nice to discuss, let academics come, let clerics come, let's discuss this out. But I, as a national American cleric, when I go to sleep at night, it's not my primary concern, what do I do with the text about adultery? Because we're not calling for the implementation of Islamic law in America. I don't know of a single organization or cleric or institute that is saying, let's abolish the US Constitution and let's supplant it with the Sharia. That is a figment of Fox's imagination. It's not a reality on the ground. Again, let me be frank here. It simply doesn't exist. Go and interview any Muslim, even the irony, when Fox News needs to find a Muslim radical, they always have to go to somebody in Europe. They can't even find a radical here in America. They always have to go and get some radical cleric somewhere in Belgium or London or whatnot, and then interview him as if he's representative of the entire Muslim world. So I agree with you. If and it does happen in Afghanistan, these are issues that, yes, at some level, the Muslim polity should come together and discuss. But what if I were to quote you bizarre incidents in America or amongst Christians and then link it to you? I mean, let me give you an example that perhaps will help you understand. Imagine if you had never ever stepped foot in America and never met an American in your life. And day in and day out for years, your only window into America was the Jerry Springer show. Do you understand this is how we feel when you bring up these incidents? Do you understand this is how frustrated it becomes? Like, I have never met somebody in my life that was stoning or partic-. These are things that happen, and the fact that one incident happens in the world and it's reported is not in any way indicative of our religion. Just like what you see on Jerry Springer, yeah, it does happen in America, but is it representative of America? The very reason why it's on Jerry Springer is because it's not representative. You see my point here? So we need to be a little bit more cautious about these types of incidents and understand, I'm sure it does happen, but even in Afghanistan, it's not the norm. If it were the norm, it wouldn't be reported in the news. even there, it's not something that's a daily reality. And yes, at some level, we do need to come together as a Muslim polity and discuss it. The last question was, Rahil? What was that? Something about the honor killings. Yeah, honor killings. Okay, the honor killings. Very good. The honor killings. Honor killings. Once again, a very sad reality that once again is blown out of proportion. Does it happen? Yes, it does. How often? You do the statistics, find out. There are more cases of domestic murder here in America than honor killings, of spouses murdering spouses because of jealousy, than honor killings. And in fact, that is a type of honor killing, by the way. When a spouse murders another spouse because they were caught in an affair, what is that? It's a type of honor killing, except that it's between spouses, okay? That is more common in America than honor killings. Does it happen in the Muslim world? Yes, it does. But again, to take this one bizarre act, and then, now in this case, I can thankfully say, without sugarcoating it at all, that honor killings are not at all a part of Islamic law. That this is something that is tribal and cultural, and that every mainstream cleric, every school of law, has sanctioned honor killings as being illegal, and something that goes against the Islamic tradition. Again, one needs to understand that those societies were tribal in nature, and they did certain things, and they continue to do certain things in the name of their tribal honor. The religion of Islam does not ever sanction honor killings. You don't ever take the law into your own hand and kill somebody. And even in Islamic law, premarital intercourse has no punishment of death whatsoever. Premarital intercourse, you might be imprisoned for a year or something in classical law, but no, there is no death for premarital. Yes, it is true, I'm not going to sugarcoat. Adultery, if you're married and you cheat on your partner, classical medieval Islamic law did have the death penalty. I'm not going to lie to you, yes. But premarital, no way. So to say that a father or a brother should kill, you know, the daughter or the sister because they've had a boyfriend or something, yes, it happens. Number one, it's extremely rare. And number two, it has everything to do with culture and tribalism and nothing to do with the religion of Islam. You can Google fatwa against honor killing and you'll find tons and tons of fatwas, religious verdicts by all mainstream scholars saying that this is not part of the religion of Islam. And the same goes for FGM, female genital mutilation, right? Again, so many people say, oh, those Muslims practice FGM. Do you know FGM is a practice that is done by Christians, Muslims, and animists of a certain region in Africa? Has nothing to do with religion, any religion. Everybody in that region, there are Christians who practice FGM, there are Muslims, and there are animists. Animists, the ancient religions, paganism. What combines them? Geography. There's one region in the world, in sub-Saharan Africa, there's a particular region there, where, for whatever reason, they practice FGM. And they're still practicing it. So to concentrate on the Islamic side of things while neglecting that this is a cultural practice that transcends religion. And again, it's nothing to do with the religion. So when it comes to FGM and honor killings, I can honestly tell you, both of them have nothing to do with the religion of Islam. In fact, they are antithetical to the teachings of the Islamic faith.
Thank you. How do we know that women that wear the hijab aren't part of ISIS? How can our fellow Americans tell the difference?
Women in hijab, any of you ISIS, please raise your hand. The notion that a woman who covers herself would somehow be complicit in ISIS. I mean, let me reverse the question. How do I know a person wearing the cross isn't a member of the KKK? Why do you assume that a person who's a Muslim is somehow sympathetic to terrorism? I just gave you the statistics, actually. 0.00125% of the entire Muslim world. And here in America, less than 40 or 50 young men from 10 million. The FBI has said that the greatest domestic terrorism threat comes from the far right groups, not from Muslim radicals. More people die in America from furniture accidents than from Muslim terrorists. You should fear your sofa more than you should fear your Muslim neighbor. So this fear that already exists, that how do I know a Muslim in hijab isn't somehow a member of the terrorist organization? I mean, again, look at the statistics. how many mass shootings took place in the last 10 years. You know the magazine Mother Jones, very famous magazine Mother Jones, they had the most exhaustive survey of mass shooters for the last 25 years. Would it surprise you to discover the profile of a lone mass shooter? Of what race, what background? Caucasian, white, Christian, male. Am I scared of every Caucasian, white, Christian, male that I see? Even though statistically, there's more of a chance he's going to be a lone shooter than a Muslim being a member of ISIS, statistically speaking. No, this is exactly what paranoia does, where you think one person is somehow representative of the worst thing you've ever seen in your life. And all I can tell you is, rather than cower in fear, go out and say hi to that girl in hijab. Go out and say hi to her and say, how are you doing? What's your name? Humanize them. Break bread with them. Ask them where they're from and what they're doing. And the more you did that, the more you do that, the more you'll realize that it's really in your mind, this figment of fearing. And by the way, I have to say this. We have our sisters sitting here who are dressed very similar to ladies in hijab. And you wouldn't think that they're any way associated with anything like that. So we have others in hijab as well that we also have to give a shout out for. Okay.
The process of demonizing the other side begins by dehumanizing them. What can we as Muslims and Americans do to rehumanize the other side while being faced with the fear of rocking the boat? How can we get a better and more positive representation while jolting the mainstream society and of their comfort zone?
Wow. You want to answer that in 2 minutes? Wow. I think what you're asking is really... Every person has a role to play. Every person. I can't answer that question except generically. What capacity do you have to reach out to others? Some of you are doctors, others are students, others are engineers. Some of you are involved in social work, others are just running your own business. Whatever you're doing, look at how you can positively impact your circle of influence. And the amazing thing is that all of us here have a different circle of influence. There's no two people in the world that have the exact same circle of influence. And we as Muslims believe that God is not going to ask you about global problems and what you did to solve them. God is going to ask you, we believe as Muslims, about what did you do to impact your circle of influence? What did you do to better your family, your friends, your neighbors, your colleagues? And the answer to that question varies from individual to individual. What is your potential? What are your strengths? What are your weaknesses? What can you do? For some of us, maybe you're not going to be famous and on the limelight and on the stage. But guess what? God's not going to ask you, did you reach 10,000 people? He's going to say, did you smile when the customer came in and treat him the way that our Prophet Muhammad wanted you to treat other people? Were you genuinely kind and compassionate to the person on the street who didn't have food? Did you give him, as the Quran says, literally Muslims know this, that they give of their food even though they love that food and need it themselves. They give of their food to the orphans and the yatim and the miskin. This is in the Quran. Did you do that? So, yes, it's true. We think globally, but we act locally. And that is an Islamic maxim. What can you do? Just be a better human in whatever circumstances you are. And be kind and compassionate and merciful. And realize this is the message of all the prophets. Abraham, Moses, Jesus, Muhammad. This is what religion is about. Love God with all of your heart. And love your neighbor and your friend and your colleagues and people around you with all of your heart as well. Isn't that the message of every single prophet? That's how you bring about a better world.
Okay, so this question begins with, dear kind sir, can you please give us your most important guidance to law enforcement in the United States?
Law enforcement is of various stripes. We're not talking about, so you can talk about police, you can talk about the FBI, the federal, each one is different. I think the question is more to the federal because they're the ones that deal with terrorist crimes. I've had very frank conversations with the FBI in many cities, and in Memphis we have a very good relationship with the FBI. And really, the FBI, unfortunately, they don't have a universal policy. Each branch is somewhat independent in its methodology. And I think that's a bit of a problem. I wish they had a more uniform methodology. Some branches and some cities are a bit more hostile to the mosques and communities, and some branches are more open and willing to cooperate. And I think that that is the way to go, that the FBI does need to understand, and thank God in Memphis, we are on the same page here. I have a very good relationship with the FBI and then the counterterrorism officials there, and we know we're working on the same side. That is really the spirit, that there's gotta be a genuine understanding that when it comes to an actual case of real terrorism, not manufactured terrorism, of real terrorism, we are on the same side. We are more terrified of that terrorist than you are, because we know what the repercussions are going to be. So as long as that attitude is there, the rest is just detail. The rest is just, what are we gonna do? We are the best line of defense. And if we can cooperate, and this is one of the points that I've mentioned to many senior FBI agents, that look, you know, if you find this young kid online, because they're the ones monitoring online conversations, I don't know even what members of my own community are doing online. But they are, as we know, they're monitoring this type of stuff. And I've said to them, look, if you come across some 19-year-old kid who's really angry about things going on, it's all legal, it's all within the First Amendment, I've said to them, come to me. Let me deal with this young angry man. Rather than set him up and send him to jail, let me talk to him. This man has potential. His passion can be channeled to something positive. We can tap into that energy. Tell him to go get an education, become a journalist, go and expose whatever crime you're angry about. Let the world know, rather than join those radical groups and think you're doing something. But instead of doing that, what do they do? What do? Some cities, thank God Memphis is not amongst them. Some cities, they view this to be another feather they can put in their cap. And they say, oh, we can have another counterterrorism case. I mean, I hope you understand, when you have statistics that 97% of Islamic radicals in America are constructed by the FBI, that is just not right. And I'm sorry, but you have to change your tactics. These aren't real terrorists. These are kids that are mentally troubled, that don't understand things about life. All of them are young. All of them are overzealous and undereducated. Rather than, you know, set up this sting operation and spend millions of our tax dollars until finally they press a false button they thought is going to blow something up, and then they go to jail for the rest of their lives. As long as it, and because again, maybe some of you don't know what I'm talking about here, but in a nutshell, what happens is when they come across this angry kid and he's doing everything legal, just angry at foreign policy, what they'll do is they'll send an informant who is a pretend radical, and they'll convince this 19-year-old to sign up, and they'll sell him false goods, and they'll construct a bomb for him, and they'll let him do everything until finally, you know, he has to push the trigger, and he does it. Then the FBI turns out everybody around him was in fact sting operation. Everybody was planted. And the people that, so this kid would never have gone down that route. Never, unless we spent $1 million with 5 agents, befriending him over a year, and then we capture him. And there are many articles, just Google this. I mean, there are many articles that have exposed this tactic, and it's just not right. What happens is not only do you destroy this young man's life, you actually traumatize a community. Because you took away one of our own, who didn't need to go down that route. Just imagine if we followed this tactic on the war on drugs. Just imagine if we found a 17-year-old kid and we sold him false weed and we said, go and sell it on the streets. Would that curb drug problems? That's not the way you fight crime or terrorism. So my appeal to law enforcement officials on the FBI, I mean, ask for the police and whatnot, then that they're not generally involved in the terrorism issues, and they're involved in regular stuff that we're all afflicted with. My appeal to the FBI is simply to understand that that tactic is the most counterproductive tactic. It's wasting our tax dollars, it's destroying lives, and most importantly, it traumatizes communities. And a lot of minorities understand what I'm talking about here. When you have COINTELPRO, when you have these types of things going on, you don't trust law enforcement, and that's not good. Law enforcement is meant to protect us, not to entrap us. Okay, so that's my answer.
ISIS derives at least one aspect from the Quran, which is about the slaves of the land being your left hand and the conqueror being the owner. ISIS uses this to claim women. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, ISIS derives many things from the Quran. There's no denying that. They view themselves as being following the Quran. So I'm not saying that ISIS doesn't view itself as being Islamic. I'm saying, is their interpretation normative, mainstream, orthodox? That's the question I'm asking, right? I'm not saying that ISIS is coming out of agnosticism. Of course, ISIS claims allegiance to the text. And of course, as a religious movement, they are backing up their practices. In fact, they're doing the most bizarre things, and they're claiming the sanction of Islam. And I gave the example of burning the Jordanian pilot alive, which was roundly condemned. It was one of the most shocking things that they have ever done. And no scholar ever historically has sanctioned anything so bizarre. So it is true that ISIS, and the point is, they justify that. They attempted to justify that Islamically as well. So the point is that ISIS does indeed view itself as being Islamic, but the question is this how normative Islam is practiced? And again, all you need to do is look at where else in the world are Muslims invading and taking slaves and killing men and enslaving their women. That doesn't happen. And the fact that ISIS is the only group that is doing this is enough for us to pause and realize that is not normative Islam. Did Muslims practice slavery once upon a time? Yes, of course they did. But there were abolitionist movements in Islam 150 years ago, just like in Christianity. From 1850 to 1900, every Muslim civilization came to terms with slavery and banned it. So it is true, medieval Islamic law has certain laws, and again, that. But 1850 onwards, Morocco, Tunisia, Saudi Arabia, Algeria, every single country, just like Europe, maybe Europe did it before, I agree, Europe did it before, but the world moves on. And every Muslim country banned slavery more than 100 years ago. And there are no more Muslim countries that are practicing slavery. So for ISIS to go against this unanimous consensus, and here's another point here, that according to Islamic law, there's something called unanimous consensus. I believe there's something equivalent in some branches of Christianity when the clergy come together and they vote on something and then that becomes law or something like that. I'm not sure of the technicalities, but there are councils that come together and they enact laws. Muslims don't have a pope figure. The Catholics do. Muslims don't have a pope figure. There's no one figure that decides the law. So how is law decided and transformed? Sunnis believe in something called unanimous consensus. Unanimous consensus is when the clergy basically agree on something, then the followers are bound to that unanimous consensus. Slavery is one of those things that 100 years ago, unanimous consensus, it's gone. And it's completely now, therefore, not considered a part of Islam. For ISIS to go against unanimous consensus, and that's actually one of the criticisms in the letter to al-Baghdadi, that one that we released, we quoted this issue of slavery, and we said, you have contravened a fundamental principle of Sunni law by jumping over unanimous consensus, by making yourselves the representatives. You can't do that according to Sunni law. That slavery has been abolished, and for you to ignore that abolishment and to go back and resurrect it contravenes fundamental tenets of Sunni Islam. So does ISIS practice it? Yes, it does. Is it in accordance with modern Sunni interpretation of Islam? No, it is not. And just read the letter to al-Baghdadi and you will see for yourself what I'm talking about.
Okay, this next question begins with salam. What do you have to say to young people who go to school and or work and are experiencing hatred or any kind of backlash? What should we do? How do we cope? How do we educate? Who should we talk to?
Very good question. Realize that you're not the first, and sadly you won't be the last, to experience racism and bigotry. Realize you're not the first and you won't be the last. Racism is as old as human beings are. And in every civilization, certain people have discriminated against others. So understand and take courage in every single person before you who has been discriminated against. Learn from their struggles. Be it the prophets of God, be it the people involved in the civil rights, be it abolitionists, whoever it was, you're not alone. There are many people like you who have felt the same fear, the same anguish, the same feeling of not being as human. But guess what? No one can take away your inner strength and freedom other than yourself. So if you can regain your own inner strength against that racism and bigotry, there is nobody who is freer than you are. No one can strip you of your dignity unless you let them strip you of your dignity, because that's internal. So if you're able to be that courageous young man, young woman, to understand that I am just as human as everybody else, and that because this person is discriminating against me merely because of my skin color, merely because of my faith or my creed, frankly, that makes him lesser of a true human being because I'm recognizing his humanity. If you're able to get to that level of courage, then honestly, you've solved the inner problem of racism, but that still leaves the outer problem. And the outer problem is a long process. Some would even argue a never-ending process. Some would argue. Bit of a pessimism here, but the reality is racism never goes away. Racism never goes away. Do we not see what's happening with the hashtag Black Lives Matter? I mean, how can we be blind that 50 years later we still have to have a discussion about how African Americans are treated? How can we be blind to this reality? And now we're starting with Latinos, Hispanics, the Asian community. I mean, this is the reality of the world we live in. So the question is coming from a Muslim. Realize that you're not alone. Lots of people are suffering the same. And the only way to reclaim your narrative is to let you speak on behalf of yourself. Nobody can claim your narrative unless you let them to. You're an American. You're a Muslim. There's no conflict between that identity. And you will have to get the bravery and the courage to explain your narrative as you are. Because if you're going to be silenced by the voices of bigotry, if you're going to be silenced by the voices of hate, that's when the voices of hate have won. As long as you have the courage to speak out and to affirm your identity, and to always be on the side of the truth. And this is what I believe as a Muslim. As a Muslim, we believe this. And many people here believe it, even if they're not Muslim. But this is an Islamic tenet. That eventually truth prevails. Eventually truth prevails. Even if, you know, you have to go to jail like Martin Luther King. Even if you have to go to jail like Muhammad Ali when he was asked to go fight in Vietnam. And he goes, I'm not going to go fight against people that have never harmed me to win corporate wars, whatever. Muhammad Ali went to jail in the 60s, right? Back then, he was blacklisted. Martin Luther King could never have imagined in the 60s or the 50s that there would be a day that we all celebrate his memory. He could never have imagined that there are multiple stamps in his name, because it's so convenient now to claim Martin Luther King as a hero. The fact of the matter was, he wasn't a hero when he was alive. Meaning, you understand what I'm saying? To the people at the time, he was viewed as a traitor. You understand what I'm saying? To the people alive at the time, I mean, look at the FBI, what's his name? The guy, the head of the FBI, what's his name? Edgar Hoover, yeah, J. Edgar Hoover. Look at J. Edgar Hoover and how he viewed Martin Luther King. Right? So what do we believe? Truth is not on the side of J. Edgar Hoover, even though power was on his side at the time. We as Muslims believe that the truth shall prevail, that power eventually will go to those who are weak and oppressed. And political power is nothing. Power, we believe, comes from God himself. Muslims, what do we say? La hawla wala quwwata illa billah. The Islamic phrase means what? There is no change, nor is there any power except by the permission of God. That's what we believe. So stand on the side of truth, and eventually God shall give you the power to set you free.
How should we as Muslim parents address radical Islam to our children?
Radical Islam from there's two ways that we need to get approach this question. The first is the innocent child who's wondering, why are these people doing what they're doing in the name of Islam, right? That, and I'll never forget. I was in New Haven. I was going to Yale for my PhD, and my son was in grade one. My son was born in 2000, so I mean he has no clue of 9/11. This is now grade one. This is 2005, right? 2005 was in grade one. 2005, 2006, and he comes home one day, and he says, Baba, who is Bin Laden? Six-year-old kid. Who is Bin Laden? And my wife and I just, like, froze. Why are you asking? My friend at school called me Bin Laden. And my jaw just dropped, like,
what type of household does that other child come from? My son doesn't even know his friends are Christian, Jew, Muslim. Like, my son is so innocent at that age, he doesn't even know that there is the other. Do you understand? Like, he doesn't even categorize. And he comes over and says, my friend said I'm bin Laden. And I just could not fathom how a six-year-old is taught to register that this kid is a Muslim and that therefore he must be a terrorist. That was one of the most awkward discussions my wife and I ever had with this, my six-year-old son at the time. We literally had to explain to him 9/11 as a six-year-old. I didn't want to explain to him 9/11 as a six-year-old. I didn't want to tell him what happened. He's too young. But unfortunately, that innocence was stripped from him when his friend, and exclamation marks, his apostrophe, is calling him that. And that is a very awkward conversation. And you know what his first question was, why would a Muslim do something like that? Because in his mind, Muslims represent the mosque and friendliness and playing in the park and whatever else we're doing. Like, it's just not fixing in his mind. Why would a Muslim do? And you need to explain to him, you know, there are some Muslims, they're bad people as well. Just because you're a Muslim doesn't mean you're good. Just because you're Christian doesn't mean you're bad. There are good and bad in every faith community. That's an awkward conversation, but hopefully you don't have to have it at 6 years old. But at some point in time, you do have to have your kids introduced to the fact that there are radical Muslims out there and explain to them that, you know, there are people that are doing bad in the name of every religion. The more difficult conversation, which is much more rare, what if a young man or woman is actually flirting with radicalism? And that's rare, but it does happen, even if it's 0.01%, but whatever it is, it's still there. What if a young man is genuinely espousing that rhetoric? And that's where really you do need to get professional help. By professional help, I mean clergy or religious figures that can take on these challenges and deconstruct them. Because this young boy, if he's listening to those types of rhetorics online, that type of rhetoric does need to be deconstructed. It's not that simple to do. Because the version of the world this young mind is getting is Muslims are oppressed. And so much bloodshed is being done to them. And the list of grievances goes on and on and on. The pictures are absolutely gruesome and whatnot. And this person feels that nobody's doing anything to defend the Muslims. Believe it or not, you know the adage that one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. We need to understand that adage is very true when it comes to Al-Qaeda and ISIS. They view themselves, of course I don't, they view themselves as freedom fighters. They view themselves as defending the innocence of Palestine, the innocence of Iraq, the innocence. And they're like, who's going to defend these people? For how long are they going to be killed and more drones and more bombs? So to get to that mentality requires longer conversations. And unfortunately, I can't give you a simplistic answer. However, there are many good lectures online. I've given some of them, others have given others, where we actually do deconstruct the arguments from a historical and a theological perspective. Because another point as well, by the way, studies have shown, and there's lots of studies that have been done on these young men and women that have joined these movements, studies have shown that there's a certain personality profile of people who join these movements. I mean, frankly, you have to be somewhat crazy to think it's legitimate to kill people like that, right? It's a personality profile. By and large, they are introverts. They're very to themselves. They don't have a social life. By and large, they themselves have a lot of times imbalances, personality imbalances, and a lot of times they are people who rediscover the faith rather recently. They're not people that come from stable religious families. Rather, they rediscover the faith on their own and they go from 0 to 100 in 2 seconds. Like, they think they're all of a sudden, you know, super Muslim and super, and they don't go gradually. And it takes a while. And one of the main narratives of ISIS is, do not listen to your local clerics and preachers. Do not listen to your local scholars. Listen only to us. We're the ones who are preaching the truth. They're going to brainwash you. And so it really, and I have spoken to young men, by the way, parents have called me up and I've gone and spoken to them. It is possible. And I can, you know, thankfully I can say that everybody I've spoken to about this, thank God, I mean, nothing has happened and they've kind of, you know, come back. But that's not, the point is that there is a narrative that needs to be deconstructed. And that narrative can be deconstructed, but it requires more knowledge, and it also requires a psychological understanding of the person you're talking to. So if that exists, then reach out to local imams and reach out to people that can help. And I believe that it is possible to channel that energy to something more productive. And I've told many of these young men that were so angry and whatnot, I said, you know, you need to channel that anger and do something positive for the community. Go into journalism, for example, right? Or go into this, or go into an NGO, and or go work with refugees. There are things that you can do when you feel so passionate about. You can make the world a better place. By you joining this movement, you're going to make the world a worse place. And I can say, thank God, that people I've spoken to, alhamdulillah, that hasn't happened. But I can't give an easy answer. I'm sorry. It's as best as I can do.
What do you say about governments of Muslim countries sponsoring terrorist movements, such as Qatar supporting the Taliban, Saudis supporting Al-Qaeda, and Iran supporting Hezbollah?
I'm sorry, that's just too simplistic. It's just not valid. This is very simplistic, and there are many other factors at play. The government of Saudi Arabia, for example, to claim that it supports Al-Qaeda is really preposterous. Al-Qaeda has killed more Saudis than Americans. Al-Qaeda has had more bombs go off in Saudi Arabia than in America. And so to claim that the government actually wants to support Al-Qaeda, the government actually was the one that expelled bin Laden himself. The government stripped bin Laden from his Saudi citizenship. That is exactly why he went to Afghanistan. So do a little bit more research. It's a bit simplistic to say that these regimes, and I'm not defending the regimes. The regimes have their own issues. I mean, I kind of agree with Salafis that politics is a dirty field, and almost every politician ends up doing things. But I think it's somewhat simplistic to say this. Saudi Arabia has its issues, no doubt, but so does every country. It's not as if our country has, I mean, every country has its negatives and positives. And they definitely do have some major foreign policy issues they need to discuss, but supporting Al-Qaeda is not one of them. Saudis themselves and the government of Saudi Arabia are very much anti-Al-Qaeda. As for Iran and Hezbollah, that is a more complicated topic, and it's not, I mean, so much to say. I mean, this is political science here. Look, in the end of the day, every country supports things that are in its interest. And we as a country also support movements in our interest. So it's a two-way street here. Just like we're criticizing them for supporting things that they like, and I am critical of them as well, let us realize we also have quite a lot of baggage on our side, right? And so that's the nature of global politics. We too are in this very dirty field, and we have supported and continue to support very, very evil regimes or whatnot, and that's the nature of politics. So as we criticize Iran, as we criticize Saudi Arabia, as we criticize, realize we too are worthy of some of that criticism if we look at our own policies. There is no angel in the room of global politics. And I that's all I can say for now. But education. Read more, read multiple sides. Every issue has two sides to the coin, and every country has its own scenario. So that'll answer that question for now, I guess. Otherwise, take my class at Rhodes. That's all I can say. Okay. Last question.
How do American educators help combat the influence that some politicians who promote hate and divisiveness and insults?
American educators, so we're talking about teachers, professors, we're talking about people in the education industry. Again, I think humanizing the other. One of the things that I think is very necessary is to reach out to your local mosque and have a Muslim come and speak. Just humanize them. I'm very happy to say in Memphis, a number of schools have reached out to me. I've spoken to a number of high schools, colleges. Just an intro, like what exactly, and have arrange a mosque visit as well. One of the things that I do for my intro to Islam class, so I teach many classes, one class is Introduction to Islam. As a part of the syllabus, they have to visit a local mosque. They have to go and see. And the overwhelming response is, and because most of my class is Christian, Rhodes is a very Christian university, Presbyterian, and you know, it's a very, Tennessee is a very, you know, as you know, very conservative state. Most of these are church-going people. And the overwhelming sentiment is, wow, it's so similar to what I do at church, except that it's in Arabic, but it's so similar, the feeling and the, and that's exactly the point, that if you were to only go and see
what Muslims are doing or peer Muslims or interact with them, you wouldn't have this othering. You can't otherize, right? The one that, as I said before, you're breaking bread with and joking with. It's really not possible. So my advice to everybody, not just educators, but everybody, is reach out. Reach out across the aisle. Reach out to somebody you've never met before. Interact with them. And sure, their food might be slightly different, maybe spicier. Sure, their dress code might be a little bit different. But in the end of the day, they are just as human. And they want to live the same lifestyles, better education for their kids, just a good neighborhood. Everybody wants that. And all you need to do is to humanize the other. Reach out to them, intermingle with them. And especially educators, I think they have a bigger responsibility because they're put in charge of lots of young minds. That's their job, to make sure that the kids in their class do not be swayed by such rhetoric. And I think that the truth shall be on our side, and that's the reality, as I said, the prophetic message, that if we try our best to spread the compassion and mercy that is the under threat of every single religion, if we try our best to love our neighbors and our peers with all of our hearts, I do think that eventually we will cause an impact, maybe not on the globe, but at least in our own local communities. And guess what? If we change our local communities, if all of us change our local communities, we would in fact impact the globe. And that is the ideal that we all strive for.
This marks the end of the Q&A session. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Dr. Kadhi.
Thank you for having me. Thank you very much.
Now, I have the tough job of speaking after Dr. Kadhi. I think I should go home. Did everybody enjoy the evening? Assalamu alaikum. My name is Samia. We often hear the verse of the Holy Quran from Surah Al-Hujurat. O mankind, we created you from a single pair and made you into tribes and nations so that you may know each other. Now, God addresses mankind here. That is every human being, regardless of his faith or no faith at all. The Arabic word for no is latta arafu. This word has many deep meanings. It can mean to intimately experience each other, to get to understand the level of humanity in each one of us. Then we respect each other and we move on beyond respect. We come to a realization that our concerns, our problems, our goals, our aspirations, and sometimes our beliefs are the same. We all seek the same things in our lives: a peaceful life, the best hereafter, morality, happiness, justice, and a great community to live in where everyone shares the same rights. Now, we are all guided by the divine light. It is the extremists and the terrorists that are not guided, but they are blinded by the light. In this increasingly materialistic and narcissistic world, in our own congregations, we have to stamp out hate and do not let bigotry pass without checking it. If we do not, the future for our children will be a dangerous thing to have, where religion will not have much meaning. Now, my job is to thank everyone. First and foremost, we are thankful to Almighty God, without whose help nothing is possible. And we have to thank Dr. Kadhi for honoring us with this visit and sharing his wisdom with us. I wish we could have a chip that I could take and put into every Muslim. Thank you. Another round of applause. And to my beautiful MCs, stand up, Amara, Shireen, and the young man who did the translation. And believe me if I tell you, you see all the Muslim women with the hijab, some without the hijabs, and that's okay. Let me tell you, most all of them have at least a degree. They might be homemakers, but they are just as educated as anyone else. And I'm proud to be one Muslim woman. And we thank most especially each and every one of our VIP guests and all of the other people who have come here. You're all champions of justice. Miss Tiffany, for being a brave young soul who speaks up against prejudice of all kinds. Thank you. Miss Patty Kim, for looking out for the disenfranchised and for trying to pass the House bill along with all of us against racial profiling. Didn't go through, but she tried. Miss Anne Van Dyke, please can you stand up? Now, she is one of the leading experts in this country for white supremacist groups. And she stands between the hate group and the minority and says, not on my watch, you don't. She looks frail. She may look frail and old, but she packs a powerful punch. And Sister Romaine and all the other sisters, my goodness, what would this community be without your hospitals? And you are angels of mercy. And I have personally been in your hospitals and I was treated like a VIP myself. Thank you. And all the Pakistani doctors who helped finance this, without your support, we would not be able to pull off this. And Mike Sands, thank you for always being supportive. Dr. Pickens and Ruth, you're always there for all of us. I saw Gregory Jeffrey Beringer right here in his wheelchair. I guess he's not here anymore, from the PHRC. Thank you, sir. And Crown Plaza, are you guys here? Crown Plaza, Jamie, Matt, and the rest of the staff, you have all bent over backwards to accommodate us, and we are grateful to you. The volunteers, thank you so very much. I just thanked you, Matt, and the staff of Crown. We are grateful to you guys. Thank you. Now, the heroes are the volunteers. They are the ones that worked hard to pull this whole thing together. Thank you. May Allah reward you. Now, lastly, I would be remiss if I do not acknowledge the great efforts and hard work of the steering committee. Dr. Adil, can you please stand up? Asma, can you come here? Asma Nizam. Dr. Malik, he's somewhere, Brother Shahul Hamid, and Brother Qadir, along with all the volunteers who took the lead. Thank you. For some housekeeping, should we conclude the dua, do the housekeeping first? All right, housekeeping. Sheikh is going to do the dua. He's going to pray the end of this event. And after that, we ask our VIP, our guests, please kindly bear with us. And you, brothers and sisters, use your sabr. Use your sabr. We want this to go very smoothly and very nicely. Our VIPs will go and get some snacks, and then all of us can slowly. I will identify which group will be going. So if we can do that, I know this is hard, but we can do it. I'm going down. The next one, the people who are parked across the street at the Market Square Garage, if you can bring your you go downstairs to the connoisseur's desk and pay there for the discounted price. Otherwise, you'll be charged $25 across the street. So the $15 charge, you have to pay downstairs at the bottom of the steps across from the elevators. Is that good?
Let us conclude with a brief prayer. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Maliki Yawmiddin. Iyaka na'budu wa Iyaka nasta'in. Ihdina as-sirat al-mustaqim.
صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين آمين. O our Lord, we ask you to bring about a peace in our hearts that cleanses it from all grief, from all sorrow, from all hate, from all xenophobia, from all bigotry. O Allah, O our Lord, O our Creator, whatever name we use to call you, O our Lord, we ask you for ultimate salam, which is peace. We ask you to be genuine brothers and sisters in humanity. We ask you that you make each and every one of us an instrument of good, an instrument of mercy, an instrument of compassion to each other. We ask you that you allow us to follow in the footsteps of all of your mighty prophets and all of your noble worshippers, so that we spread love and peace in this earth as you had wanted us to do. O our Lord, cause our hearts to be united in peace so that we can bring about peace in this world. Amen. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.